You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the f***ing best.
Each week, Shea Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out six pop culture themed trophies for six basketball related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto, I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill You Might Win Some, But You Just Lost One trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
Blue Wire.
First pick in the 1991 NBA draft, the Charlotte Hornets select Larry Johnson from University.
I'm not supposed to be here, man. A lot of people from where I'm from, so don't make it.
Charlotte, we're back.
Welcome in to another BuzzBeat podcast. It's Brian Geisinger here. No Spencer Percy, no Richie Randall today as we go ahead and continue our preview edition series for the 2021-2022 NBA season on the Southeast Division. Richie recorded with Beyond the Arcade to do a preview for the Magic season. And we're going to get into the Atlanta Hawks tonight. These are just a good way to get ready for the season and talk with some people that know these teams, you know, a little bit better than we do. We've got Miami and Washington coming in the pipeline as well. So should be some good stuff. And then we'll also have a big Hornets preview pod before the season starts as well. And it's crazy. Preseason games, training camp, media days, like all that stuff is like happening now or right around the corner. Make sure to rate and review this podcast on Apple Podcast if you haven't already. Or you're a new listener, we always appreciate that, and it helps with the yield algorithm. But without further ado, let's go ahead and hop into this. I'm joined by a great guest tonight. This is, in my opinion, one of the best, if not the best, Atlanta Hawks follow that you can pick up on Twitter. Contributor over at Peachtree Hoops. Andrew Kelly at Twitter at @AndLanKell. I hope I spelled that right. Anyways, Andrew, welcome in and thanks for joining us. How are you doing, man?
I'm good. You did spell it right, by the way. But yeah,
all right,
I'm glad to be
all
here. Recording on a Friday night. I'm getting ready for the weekend.
Yeah, exactly. And really, what better way to kick off a weekend than to talk about Trae Young pick and rolls and John Collins extensions and that sort of stuff. But this is great. I've known Andrew for a little bit, just interacting on Twitter, and this is the first I'm hearing his voice. So really groundbreaking moment in Southeast Division podcast history here. But let's go ahead and jump right in. You know, the Hawks really really put together quite a charmed season a year ago. I think really one of the more entertaining and fun teams in the league. Great roster, lots of talent, the incredible run, getting to within, what, two games, I guess, of making the NBA Finals.
Yeah, two games.
Yeah, two games. Yes, the Milwaukee six-game series here. You know, and obviously the season really took a turn after they made the coaching change from Lloyd Pierce to Nate McMillan. Hawks go 27-11 in the regular season. Once they flip the switch to Nate, they beat New York and Philadelphia in the playoffs, and really have just sent the Sixers franchise into a state of disarray which continues into the precipice of the 2021-2022 season. But look, Andrew, it's probably hard, or maybe even a little reductive, to break it down to just one to two things. But when Nate McMillan took over, it's just impossible to ignore how good this team got. Could you speak on the job that Nate did and maybe boil it down to sort of like one or two things that really like helped the Hawks take off the back half of the season and into a deep playoff run.
Yeah, I mean, you really can't say enough about the job that Nate McMillan did. I mean, when he initially took the job as a assistant coach, he always knew there was a decent probability that things might go awry and he could find himself in the head coaching position, and that's exactly what transpired. But he obviously did a very good job. There's a few different things that he made some changes from Lloyd Pierce. The first is that the pace just really slowed down. LP was always a guy he really liked to push the tempo. Nate McMillan is just more half-court oriented. They were 22nd in pace under McMillan and 16th under Lloyd Pierce. Another key area of change was they actually have a worse shot profile. So if you go to cleaning the glass and you look at the shot mix on there, if you look at location effective field goal percentage, it got a lot worse, which is kind of interesting in spite of the success. They were 26th in the league, actually, for location effective field goal percentage, which is a pretty stark decline from 10th under Lloyd Pierce. So they slowed things down. They took more mid-range shots. But, you know, you can also take more mid-range shots when you have guys like Bogdanovich and you have Kevin Huerter and you have Trae Young, who are just so good with those floaters. It makes sense to kind of seek out those shots a little bit more. But one key area where they really started to improve, I think, was that under Lloyd Pierce, they were more static offensively. Like, they didn't have a lot of ball movement. If you look at second spectrum data, they were 28th in the league in off-ball screens under Lloyd Pierce. And then under Nate McMillan, they improved to 11th. So I think that was a key area improvement, was just doing more off the ball. This was especially beneficial for Bogdan Bogdanovich, who's a very good shooter off screens. They started to utilize him more in half-court sets that way. So doing more off ball, I think, was a key area of improvement. And finally, one other area where they just really improved under McMillan was the fourth quarter. They were one of the first, one of the worst fourth quarter teams in the league under Lloyd Pierce. They just had a lot of blown leads. They just couldn't execute down the stretch. They lacked poise, and that improved dramatically under McMillan. So, he slowed the pace down. They did more off ball. They did have a worse shooting profile, so I think that's of note, and that's something that could be a factor potentially next year. But overall, Nate McMillan is just more old school. He likes to make sure guys are getting their touches and getting involved. And I just think that he brought more of a calming presence. And, that's more of a, less tangible observation, but they were just more poised, I would say, under McMillan.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about the shot profile being what it was when you have like a megawatt creator like Trey, like running pick and roll. Like, it feels like everything should just be like, pull up threes, kick out threes in rim,
And that's interesting too, because that's really what Lloyd Pierce's system was. Like, it was like a pretty, straightforward spread pick and roll kind of offense, where it was just, Trey as a quarterback and pick and roll over and over and over. And then you have, McMillan, where he's like actually running floppy sets. You don't see that too often anymore. Yeah. But he does run that. But, he did a better job, I think, of connecting pieces. Everybody kind of felt like they were a part of the offense under McMillan that they may have not under Pierce.
Yeah, that's a great point. And like, you can tell, I've actually gone and I've recently rewatched a couple Hornets Hawks games. One was when LP was still coaching them, and then one was later in the season with Nate. And obviously I watched Atlanta, basically every game they played in the postseason. You talked about those floppy sets. Like, floppy's not exactly like splitting the atom, but if you don't, in terms of like off ball movement, I mean, people have been running floppy for a long time. People are going to keep running floppy because it works. And Nate is as sort of an old school approach to some aspects of how he runs a program. But I love that set, and they've got the guys to do it. Like, you have Kevin Huerter, you have Bogdanovich, you have Cam Reddish, who I know this was a bit of a lost year for him in certain ways, and we can talk about Reddish more if we want to. But especially guys like Huerter and Bogdanovich, just like the perfect guys to bring off movement, put them in off ball games like that. Now, I even loved how on some of those floppy sets, yes, you're trying to get Bogdanovich coming off a screen or Huerter coming off a pin down. But I also kind of like that it can scramble the defense a little bit while Trey's pounding it up top. And then all of a sudden, he can just get it and go right down the middle. Like, everyone starts focusing on, oh, hell, Bogdanovich is curling off a screen. He's hasn't missed in, all night. And then all of a sudden, Trey can just go one-on-one with the defense bent. It's just a nice way to get a little bit of just, I don't know, off-ball motion, scramble the defense around a little bit before just letting Trey get to his drive game and you know, get downhill and get into the paint, which is something he's obviously incredible at doing. And I want to talk a little bit about Trey. You can't just say it. You just cannot say enough about what this dude did in the playoffs. The numbers are bonkers. 29, 10, you know, nine three-point attempts per game, nine free throw attempts per game. Just controlled everything. Had an answer for every pick and roll coverage that every team threw at him. It was amazing. Constantly turning the corner. If you took away that, he would counter, reject the screen, or get to his pull-up game. Just incredible on the fly problem solving. You know, for you, when you look at Trey and what he did this season and really coming on strong in the playoffs, what do you think struck out most about his development? Either the fact that he sort of like held up defensively, or just really like the pick and roll decision making, and sort of where do you see Trey going? I guess into what will now be his fourth NBA season.
Yeah, I think that, you know, you never really know what to expect from guys in their first playoff series, but it's just like, this is the player that he's been for several years now. You know, like, there's nothing that really, I guess, surprised me too much, at least from the offensive side. I mean, this is just, you know, what he does. I mean, it's cool to see it on the big stage, you know. I mean, he had the game winner in his first playoff game on the road in, like, a very good Garden environment, so that was obviously very impressive. He's somebody that really just kind of feeds off the crowd and, you know, people booing him. But really, when I think about, you know, where can he grow going forward? I mean, I think that most people just kind of begin with, you know, the off-ball stuff. You know, he's very, very, very much an on-ball player. So that can be sort of problematic in some ways when you're trying to get other guys, you know, reps on the ball, like Kevin Huerter, Bogdanovich, guys like that. But it's just so hard to take him off the ball too, because it's just, it's such pristine offense where you can just give him the ball and pick and roll, you know, 20 plus times a game. And like you're scoring at a very efficient level. He's producing shots for others. So that's a difficult area to see him really making major strides, you know. But he's, you know, historically he's been a good, you know, catch and shoot shooter. So it'd be nice to get him more looks there and just get other, you know, other guys involved in the offense at times. But there really wasn't a ton that, you know, really surprised me. I think you made a comment earlier that his defense was maybe less bad, I guess, than people expected in the playoffs. I think some of that too is just that most players, with the exception of like good primaries, just don't have like the isolation abilities to really take advantage of a bad defender. You know, that gets you outside of your core offense in a lot of ways. So most teams just don't have this secondary talent that can, you know, take advantage of these kind of matchups with Trey. You know, Reggie Bullock isn't going to like burn Trey Young in isolation most of the time. Yeah. So he was able to be hidden better than I think some people expected. He wasn't, you know, quite the detriment that I think people may have thought that he could be in the playoffs. And it was also kind of favorable matchup wise too. Like neither New York nor Philly really had the personnel to like abuse him that some other teams like Brooklyn might. But yeah, I think off ball is really where you like to see him grow. Just reducing turnovers, that's always a thing for young players. And I like to see him develop more of a mid-range game too. He has that incredible floater, but it'd be nice to see him develop kind of like an elbow jumper, sort of an in-between game there too. Mm-hmm. So really a few, you know, kind of minor areas, because his offense is just so good already. And, you know, obviously you'd like to see him get better from three. That's another thing too, where, you know, his reputation doesn't quite match the results from him. You know, I think he shot 31% from deep in the playoffs. He has a very tough shot profile, so it's always tough to be efficient on those. And three-point shooting is something that guys tend to get better on over their career. So I would expect that with Trey too, but that's another area where he can improve. You know, off-ball, decision-making, mid-range jumpers, and I think just overall three-point shooting is where he could stand to improve.
Yeah, the pull-up three seems like the sort of like the low-hanging fruit, obvious thing to get to. Like if he ever got that to like the high 30s reliably, like, I mean, he's already like kind of impossible to guard in the pick and roll. And I totally know what you mean about just like wanting the ball in his hands as much as possible. You know, someone who has followed the Hornets seriously the last, you know, decade or whatever. You know, Kemba Walker was not I don't think the sort of like north-south passer and decision maker that Trey was, but yeah, you wanted it to be pick and roll with him because you're just like that. They couldn't ask for a better possession really than having this guy just sort of like spread out and let, you know, let him go to work. And it feels like the mid-range could be something that like he almost doesn't even need that until like he like loses a step, you know, and then he can like, as he like turns to like the back half of his career, a la Chris Paul or whatever, then he can really,
yeah, you know, exactly,
maybe, you know, really get to that elbow game a little bit more. I feel what you're saying about the matchups maybe not being like less exploitable for teams to pick on him. And one of the Hornets games I was watching, you know, they recently, again, you know, they went at Trey with Hayward a lot in two-man actions with LaMelo and had some success doing that. But do you think having so many long, rangy wing guys behind him or that guys that you can use to switch out, switch behind the plate, your DeAndre Hunter, Cam Reddish, and then you have a guy like Clint Capella, who phenomenal last season. And if you know, we can talk about Clint as well because he was so damn good. But do you think it makes Trey tougher to pick on when you've got that many guys? You've got three guys on the court at all times that can kick him out and switch out. And if teams are trying to put Trey in, you know, little screening actions and get a switch, and then you also have Capella at the rim. Do you think that kind of defensive personnel around Trey makes those matchups tougher to get to? Because that, by that point, now what is supposed to be a simple thing, like, oh, you just take this small guy and put him in a pick and roll and attack the switch, now all of a sudden there's way more moving pieces going around behind the play.
Yeah, I think it has to. And when you just kind of look, you know, how Travis Lake has assembled this team to the draft, like, they have a lot of length on the perimeter. I mean, they have DeAndre Hunter, who's just such a versatile defender. He can defend the point attack. He can defend forwards. I mean, he's just about as versatile as it gets from a wing defender. Cam Reddish is another guy who's very effective 1-3. Obviously, you mentioned earlier, he wasn't, you know, really healthy until the very end of the playoffs. But even Kevin Huerter has improved a lot defensively. So they have a lot of size on the wings, which is interesting because, you know, outside of Trae Young, the Hawks are really a big team. And I think that sometimes people forget that, you know, they play with two bigs. They're very good at denying shots at the rim. So I think they do have personnel that can kind of, you know, hide him as best as possible. They have other guys they can use at the point of attack. And just in general, you know, when they have Collins and Capella and DeAndre Hunter all out there, their defense can actually give teams more problems than I think people anticipate. Just for an example, if you look at cleaning the glass and you look at possessions where Hunter and Capella and Collins are all on the floor together, this is only 471 possessions, so it's not a massive sample. Hunter got hurt early in the season, but they had a 95.5 defensive rating. You know, that's 100th percentile. I'm not saying that's going to last over an extended period of time, but there's a lot of advantages to playing with two bigs. You know, you can wall off the paint, you can deny shots at the rim, and when you have versatility like, you know, the Hunter offers, it does make it a lot easier to hide Trey. And, you know, you don't necessarily have to be, you know, a stifling defense when you have a guy like Trae Young. You're just trying to get the stops when you need to. And I think they have the personnel that can do that.
Yeah, for sure. And having Capella, you know, rebound every miss too. It's like you can just close off possessions.
Every miss.
Well, yeah, he was incredible last season.
Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring podcasts on the Blue Wire Network. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System yet, then you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. Wherever you are across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's unified, UNIFYD, healing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
But you brought up DeAndre Hunter, and you brought up an injury, the injuries last season that really, to an extent, stifled what was an awesome sophomore season. Look, I love DeAndre Hunter. I cover the ACC. I loved DeAndre when he was a redshirt freshman at Virginia. You knew he was just built to play in the NBA, and it was really, really cool when healthy this season to see it actually coming to fruition. Just a really talented and tantalizing young two-way forward that can basically guard, I don't even know, four positions, five positions, to, do whatever you want with him defensively, and then really has sort of like a burgeoning offensive game. What do you think is next for, first off, what stuck out with you, DeAndre, with Dre this season in limited sample just because of the unfortunate injuries, and you can go in any direction you want here. What do you think is next for DeAndre? Getting to the rim more frequently, more self-creation efforts. And I guess based off that, do you also think it's important for him to sort of make those steps in terms of self-creation? Because does Atlanta need another guy next to Trey? They can obviously play this beautiful heliocentric offense that you and I were just talking about, but would it be good to be able to have, obviously it would be good. I guess how vital is it to have like more secondary creation around Trey going forward? And is Hunter that solution? Sorry, that was a long rambling question that I just spit out at you.
I think there's a lot of different interesting areas that you pointed out there. Just to begin with, when I think about how he improved from his rookie season, I think the biggest thing that jumps out to, I think, anybody that's watched him for a period of time is just how much better his handle got. He dramatically improved his handle over this past season. He's always been a good mid-range shooter going back to UVA. I mean,
yes,
you watched him there. You're an ACC guy. He's always had that in his bag. But the refinements that he made to his handle in the offseason really allowed him to get to his spots, and he can just kill you from there once he gets to mid-range. Just to look into some of the stats this year, his self-creation got way better. He shot 52% effective field goal percentage on self-created attempts. This is using PVP stats as proxy, which, it defines a self-created attempt as holding the ball for 2 seconds or more. So he shot 52% effective field goal percentage on those, and that's up from 40% as a rookie. So that's like a 12-point percentage increase. Like I said, he's always been a good mid-range shooter, but he just got way better at getting to his spots. And sort of a comparison I've made in some ways with him is he reminds me of Chris Middleton in some ways, just the way that he can just really get to the spots in mid-range and just, assassinate teams. It's tough to deal with that. I mean, he only played, I think, like 21, something like that, games this year. So I'm not saying that the numbers would have held up, but when you look at what he shot from mid-range, I mean, he was, 54% on all mid-range shots this year. That was 96th percentile per cleaning the glass. So he was really cream of the crop there. So he was just so impressive there. As far as how he can help the Hawks in general, I think an important area that he can really contribute is that he makes it tough to put big defenders on Trey. You saw in the playoffs with the Sixers, they tried to use Ben Simmons on Trey. Teams often will like to try and put a wing, get a bigger defender on him, which makes sense when you're trying to guard him. But when you have a guy like DeAndre Hunter, often you'll get a favorable cross match. So if you get DeAndre Hunter matched up with like a 6'4 guard that, should be on Trey or something like that, he can post them up. He can take them off the dribble, and that just makes it a lot harder to use your best defender, even if that's a big wing, on Trey. And that just, you develop more counters that way. I think an important part of playoff basketball is just having a lot of different counters. You know, if you can have secondary creators that are capable of taking guys off the dribble, that are capable of resetting a possession and creating for others, I mean, that's ideally what you want. And that's sort of the, you know, ethos that the Hawks have had under Travis Schlenk. You know, they have guys like Kevin Huerter, DeAndre Hunter. They want to be versatile on the wings, like with Bogdanović. So Hunter, I think, just can really shine there as an isolation scorer. So I think that, you know, he needs to improve as a passer. I think that's like a big area. You see it every now and then. He'll flash a nice pass, but it's not consistent. So that's really what I'm looking for from him next year, because we've seen the scoring increase. So I'd like to see him improve there. But yeah, he's a critical piece for them when he's healthy.
Yeah. Again, one of the Atlanta-Charlotte games I rewatched recently, it was like less sort of like self-creation and more of him just like attacking off advantage. But he was just a closeout monster in this game. Just like, it, you know, Trey would draw extra help, kick it to Dre. And he was just like, in the second half, it was just like, there was a stretch of like seven possessions. And it was like on five or six of them, it was just like, oh, DeAndre attacked the closeout, layup, DeAndre pull up, DeAndre drop off for a dunk to Capella. It was just, it was hilarious. And you mentioned his, like the face up ISO, all that game. Again, the flashes of that at Virginia were real. The Tony Bennett ran stuff to get DeAndre these, you know, mid-range pick and pop looks out of these blocker mover sets, or down on the low block face-up sets when they would run this inside motion or inside triangle, however you want to call it. And he was just a killer at that. It's no surprise that that has translated, and it's just so cool to see the other aspects of his offense come online. And then all of a sudden, that mid-range game is now scalable, because now you have all of these other cool things. And again, he's just, like you said, he's got a ways to go still in terms of playmaking and passing and stuff. But like, man, with his jumper, with his size, getting to play next to a you know, again, just an uber creator like Trey. It's just stay healthy, man. Just stay healthy. Yeah. He's gonna be a two way monster for a long time.
I think you made a good point there too, just about attacking closeouts, because that's just such an important, you know, aspect of NBA offense now. When you have a creator like Trae Young, and you know role men like Collins and Capella, you're just sucking defenders into that middle of the court. So often you're getting an opportunity on a kickout to where you can, you know, either get to your three or you can grab and go. You just get a lot of opportunities to get downhill, and that's where guys like Hunter just truly shine.
Yeah, he's built for that. And again, you could see that when he was at Virginia, he was a little bit dependent on attacking closeouts going right. Not like completely, like he could put it and go left and stuff, but there was some sort of concern of like, oh, can he pump and go and get to his left and, you know, actually like get downhill a little bit. And again, I think this year you're starting to see more of those answers. And again, doing it around Trey, just it makes the math real simple sometimes.
Yeah. And he loves that little jab step too. Like that was a big move for him at Virginia. And I think he's becoming less reliant on that too for, you know, advantage creation. That goes back to the improved handle, but that's always been a big move for him.
He's based off that sort of that like jab rocker step kind of move. Like when he faces up, he really can weaponize that. It's fun. It's sort of, it's like old school and very technical, in a way. Well, let's switch over to another young, former ACC forward that happens to be an employee of the Atlanta Hawks as well. John Collins signed a big extension this offseason. $125 million over 5 years. Just real quickly first, is this sort of like the money you expected for Collins, like that type of deal, 125 over five? Is that in the area that you kind of had in pencil for? Or is that, you know, more or less? Where did you land on the Collins extension number?
That actually came in like, you know, a little less than I expected initially. You know, I kept, you know, close tabs, obviously, and some of the reporting had indicated that, you know, teams like San Antonio were interested, had a lot of cap space. I mean, he was one of the more coveted free agents, so I thought there was a decent possibility he could get more than that. You know, like I thought, you know, something a little less than the max could be, you know, a potential option for him from a team like San Antonio that just had a ton of cap space and presumably wanted to improve. I think he ended up getting squeezed a little bit. You know, it's tough with restricted free agents sometimes. Teams expect their teams to retain them, and that can, you tie up money when you sign them to an offer sheet, and I think that can be an issue at times. I think it's a very fair market rate. You know, The fifth year is a player option. If he plays well, he's probably going to opt out of that. So it's really more like, you know, a 4 for 100 kind of deal. And I think, you know, $25 million average annual value, I think that's very fair for a player like John Collins, who I think is, you know, roughly a top 60 or so player in the NBA. He's gotten better every year. He's improved defensively. He's really developed as a 3-point shooter. He still needs to work on his on-ball skills, you know, just attacking closeouts, making the extra pass, things like that. But he's, you know, one of the best, you know, energy bigs in the league. You know, they've had times where they've just been dead, like in multiple games against the Sixers, and he energizes them with a big dunk. He's got to be one of the elite, you know, dual threat pick and roll men in the league, you know, with his ability to both shoot and roll hard to the basket. So I think it was a favorable deal for the Hawks overall. And obviously they put a priority on continuity with the success they had. And he's a very good player.
Yeah, agreed. He's young. He's still getting, should be getting better. 25 a year. You said in that top, essentially you're paying him like a top 60 player. That's perfectly fine. Again, he's important to what they're doing right now. And for whatever it's worth, like and we're about to talk about Onyeka Okongwu a little bit, but while he is unfortunately down, Collins is also a guy that essentially functions as their backup five too, right? So like, you're getting some excess value there as well in your front court rotation, which you're going to go into the season with, you know, looking at just like the 4 or 5s. I mean, you can move Hunter around, I guess, a little bit too, but really Collins, Capella, and Gallinari, and Collins is a guy that can just play minutes for you at both spots. You talked about, I kind of think this is one of the places where, and I'm a little biased because I watched the Hornets a lot, but I think you just touched on this with Collins. It's interesting, and it's got my wheel spinning a little bit here of just like, that might be like the next evolution of like role guys are, the guy that can do everything. Cause like with Charlotte, you see this with PJ Washington, you see this with Miles Bridges. It's like, they can hard roll, they can pop, they can slip, and once you get them into space, they can put it on the court, they can shoot the jumper, they can make a little drop-off pass. It's just like, that's sort of like those kind of like space, like interior space creators, and guys that can also, again, you know, pick and pop and shoot from above the break. That's sort of a big deal. But just having like the optionality of, hey, when you have this offense that's based around this very, very talented pick and roll lead ball handler, and you want to be able to surround them with you want the toolbox just littered with guys that can, you know, are big and athletic and can do all this different stuff, but giving guys that can really be, you know, guys that can screen and then threaten as scorers and playmakers is a huge deal. And Collins fits, you know, kind of beautifully into that mold, you know? So
it's a more advanced version of play finishing. You know, if you can, you know, dunk, that's important. If you have a good pick and roll guard, just being able to roll hard to the rim and finish is extremely valuable. And that's very efficient team offense. But if you can also, you know, drop behind three and make shots from back there, then it's even more valuable. So like you said, the optionality is very valuable.
It's great. And you have a guy like Trey that's already going to draw so much attention, and then having a guy like this that can then make it even more difficult for what your backside coverages are doing, you know, depending on how, you know, if you're, let's say you trap Trey, well, all of a sudden you've got, you know, 4-on-3 and, you know, do you want that person to stunt that Collins on, you know, if he's popping or whatever, all of a sudden you're making a lot of guys have to make decisions defensively, and the Hawks have a lot of good players, and good offensive players to really like really puncture defenses once Trey creates the initial advantage. So, all right, I would like to, we could talk a little bit more about Collins, but I would actually like to flip over to another, stop me if you've heard this one, but another good first round draft pick on this Atlanta roster that I thought had a really, really nice rookie season out of Southern Cal. Onyeka Okongwu, I was high on them, very bullish with him as a prospect. I think I ended up finishing, I loved where they got Okongwu. I just thought he was a phenomenal prospect coming into the draft, and it was awesome to see him put up a good rookie season and to like not just play in the playoffs and get those playoff reps, but to be good and to like, this may sound like a small thing, but to just every game against Philadelphia, win those backup center minutes against Dwight Howard. And just like every game, you could count on it. And he got some reps against Embiid, and I mean, that's dealing with a whole other, you know, monster. Unfortunately, Okongwu, you know, was announced in late July, surgery, torn labrum, out 6 months. I believe, and you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I believe the expected return is January this season.
They're hoping for January.
Okay, that sounds good. I mean, there's just no need to rush him back, especially a guy like this that I would imagine is probably a building block for them in some way, shape, or form. But I guess I would be curious to know, what do you think is the long-term plan for Okongwu? They've got Capella. They added 2 years to his deal a couple weeks ago, I guess in early September. So he signed through 2025. We just mentioned they've got Collins extended, who is the four, but can play some backup five. What did you think about Okongwu's rookie season? And what would you like, and so I guess let's start with this. What did you think about Okongwu's rookie season? Once you answer that, I'd be curious to know what you think about the long-term sort of like projections for him specific to this roster, because there are some guys ahead of him in the rotation.
Well, you mentioned liking him as a prospect, and it just seemed like everybody liked him as a prospect. And, you know, I think there is something for everybody with Okongwu. Like, stats guys love the advanced stats profile he had. Film guys loved, you know, his mobility and the way that he can – his 10 defense. But overall, I think his rookie season, he just got better and better. He had the slow start, I think, and it was pretty common for rookies with the COVID offseason and how that affected things. And he also came into the season with an injury as well. But during the playoffs, I thought he had some really incredible flashes. He had some tough matchups at times against Embiid and Giannis, where I think he did better than I expected. You know, that was one of the knocks on him as a prospect was, you know, how would he defend guys that, because he's really undersized for a center, as you know. He's about 6'9", doesn't have a great wingspan from what we've heard. So seeing him defend guys like that in the playoffs as well as he did was incredibly impressive for a rookie. I think he got better and better. As far as how he fits into the long-term plans, I mean, I think you can make a case if you squint a little bit that there's some possibility of him becoming their second best player at some point, you know. And I don't think that's too much of a reach. You kind of heard the Bam Adebayo comparisons at times as a rookie. He doesn't quite have Bam's mobility. And, you know, obviously Bam is just a special playmaker. And we're not sure if, you know, Okongwu can even approach those levels, but you can see some of the similarities. I think where he can really distinguish himself from a guy like Capella is just his ability to make shots, you know, away from the rim. That's kind of the thing with Capella, you know. If Capella catches the ball and he's like 5 feet from the rim, the play is over. You know, he's not really someone who can make a pass. He can't make a jumper. But, you know, being able to make that, you know, Rashawn Holmes kind of push shot from short mid-range is such an important shot for bigs. And that's an area where I think Okongwu has a lot of upside. You didn't see a ton of it, but I think he does have pretty good processing for passing. And that's another area too. Like there might be some short roll upside. And that's a component of Atlanta's offense that could really use refinement. If you can have a big that, you know, Trey is so good at getting you in that short mid area. You can't always finish, you know, he can't always get you a shot at the rim, but he can get you to the short mid area pretty consistently. So if you can make that extra read and find a shooter or make a shot, that's just, you know, an incredible, you know, that's an incredibly valuable area of real estate for the Hawks, you know. So I think that if he develops as a passer, just becomes an incredible team defender, which you can see at times, like, you know, his ability to come out and defend at the level of the screen. He has really good instincts for when to help. He just seems to always know exactly when he should help defensively, which is, you know, pretty special for a guy at his age. So I can really see the upside case for him as somebody that can improve as a jump shooter, improve as a passer, and just be a bedrock of their defense as a versatile defender, you know, somebody that can play a lot of different coverages. There's just a lot of advantage to having a big like that. But yeah, I'm very excited about him. Hopefully he gets fully healthy in January.
Yeah, you mentioned just the versatility with how he can guard ball screens. I really like what he showed. There was Hornets game I was rewatching recently, and he had just a beautiful switch. Miles Bridges still scored on the play, but like Okongwu, I mean, it was scripted action the Hornets were running, and I mean, in the middle of the play with Bridges, you know, coming off this little staggered look, faking a DHO, and Okongwu just flipped onto him perfectly, like just it was small. I know it's just one little switch. But and Bridges still scored. But I mean, I would have given him a very good grade on the play defensively because it was just such a clean move and read on his part. So I'm really bullish on just all the different things you can do with him defensively, even though he is maybe on the, certainly is on the smaller side for a center. And I'm glad you brought up the passing and shooting. I think that's stuff that, I mean, hell, we didn't even have the draft. I mean, the draft was like 10 months ago. The 2020 draft was 10 months ago, which is just insane to think about. But, heading into that draft, I feel like the things with Okongwu were, where does the jump shot eventually land? Where can he be as a passer? And what that tells me is that I think he really looked good on the stuff that you were expecting him to be strong on this year, right? And the mobility, the defense, the energy plays, the ground coverage. So that I think that's I do think stuff like that is encouraging. And then you get him in your system, get him healthy, and then pick up and build and turn him into a guy that you can really play next to Trey. And I love the thought of him maybe long term being one of the perhaps their second best guy. There's so much talent on this roster, but I don't think that's like a crazy thought to have, despite Hunter, Herder, Reddish, wherever Jalen Johnson, wherever you land with some of these guys. Okongwu is awesome. All right, let's flip real quickly to the wing rotation. We've talked a fair amount about Hunter, but I would like to touch on two guys, Kevin Herder. Unless I've missed something, there's not been an extension yet for Herder.
No extension yet. He's still eligible, and there's a decent chance they make a deal, but nothing yet.
I was wondering, and so they have until the start of the season. This would be a rookie extension that would kick in after this coming season. They have until the start of this year to get it done. Is there any expectation that'll happen, or is it? Does it seem a little more likely that perhaps this team will go into restricted free agency a year from now with Kevin Herder?
I think probably 50-50 is something along those lines. I mean, I think they're willing to offer him like a pretty good 4-year deal. Not quite probably what Bogdanovich got, which is, 4 for $72 million, but something not a lot less. With the premium on guys with Herder's skill set and free agency, he may just, think it's more advantageous for himself to not sign that extension and try and chase a bigger deal. But I think there's a pretty good chance they do end up extending him 50-50 probably.
I think that sounds about right. I mean, he's going to get paid. Like you said, he's going to get paid either way. He's such a good offensive player. He can do secondary ball handling, the movement shooting, the size, like he can just do so much for you offensively on the wing. He's very, very good, young offensive, guard. I really like him a lot. And look, here's another guy that I covered at Duke, Cam Reddish. Cam had a bumpy freshman season when I covered him at Duke, but the flashes, you could see him, the steal rate, the NBA 3-point shooting range, obviously some of the the T-Mac or Paul George create comparisons coming to the draft, those were perhaps a little much, but certainly a good or an intriguing 3-and-D prospect, perhaps with a little more on ball upside too. I would be curious to know, after what was kind of a lost season up until maybe he threw in some buckets in that Bucks series because Atlanta was just so depleted, he got back into the rotation. Where are you on Reddish? And I know there's a lot of noise with him as a trade possibility, so if you want, you can touch on that too. But just where are you with Reddish heading into to year three?
Well, Reddish is a pretty polarizing player. He's someone that hasn't been particularly successful, I guess, since high school. I mean, he had really an inconsistent season at Duke, an inconsistent rookie year with some flashes, really, until the COVID suspension. You mentioned last year was effectively a lost season for him, and I would agree with that. He got injured and just never really, found his place quite again. He showed up in game 6 of the conference finals and shot very well from three. But with Reddish, he has special defensive instincts. And I think that's really where the appeal with him begins. We don't quite know how big he is now. And he's probably pushing 6'9". He's clearly added some mass. Yeah, he's a big dude. He's clearly added some mass to his frame. But he has a great wingspan. He makes excellent use of his link too in passing lanes. He has really good feel for where the ball is going to be. He's the kind of defender who can gamble and then recover. He has the physical skills to recover very well and then anticipate where the ball is going to go next. So he has really special upside there. He's a good defender 1-3. They've put him on Kyrie Irving at times. They put him on Kevin Durant at times. He can really defend a lot of different guys. Very special team defender. That's really where the positives begin with him. Offensively, it's just really been a mess for him. You know, I mean, he hasn't shot well from deep. His stroke is looking consistent at times. He has elbow flare. He has periods where he is shooting pretty well from deep, but he turns it over a lot. He's not a great decision maker. He does get fouled at a pretty good rate. He gets a pretty favorable whistle. He plays more like a big guard, really, than a forward. You know, he has more of a guard's game. He doesn't have a lot of vertical pop. You know, he has good fluidity. I think that, you know, he's probably underrated as an athlete in some ways because he is fast and he's fluid, but he doesn't get a lot of lift at the rim, and that shows up in his finishing numbers. So he's really someone that the Hawks will be looking for more consistency for. That's what Travis Schlenk has really harped on, that they're looking for from Reddish. Just when you look at their rotation, they just have so much talent on the perimeter already. So the expectations for him aren't super high. They just really need solid rotation play. That's really what they're looking for from him. So if he can deliver that, it would be a big step in the right direction. But he's someone that is in somewhat of a tenuous position. You know, when you look at the talent they have, the owner has already made comments about how they probably can't keep everybody. I mean, that's just, you know, kind of being realistic. So he's someone that, you know, it wouldn't be a surprise if he was traded. But I think there's something there with Reddish. I've always been relatively optimistic. I mean, I've never really bought the Paul George comparisons. I've always thought, you know, maybe something more along the lines of like a Houston Rockets Trevor Ariza, something like that.
Yes,
you know?
Yes, exactly.
That's what I think you're looking for from him. So it's a big year for him, clearly.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned all of those struggles that you touched on beautifully with his offense. Like, everyone who watched him at Duke could have predicted that. The rim finishing, the inconsistent shooting stroke. It was, again, he really struggled to finish at the rim, finish over guys, finish through contact when he was during that one season in Durham. But clearly a lot of talent. You mentioned the length and passing lanes. I think that's really when he's at his best defensively. Is when he's doing that stuff. And yeah, I feel like there was a week this offseason where, like, I feel like I was catching some of Hawks Twitter where people were talking a lot about how tall Reddish is now. There's a lot of people, like, looking at screen grabs and, like, you're like, oh, look, he's standing next to Jason Tatum, who's, like, you know, this tall, and he's got to be 6'9 now. So I was enjoying that. It was a funny little thing that popped up this offseason. But, all right, let's do some quick hitters and get you out of here. Really appreciate all the time here. What would you, again, we'll keep these things quick, but what do you think starting lineup and closing lineup for the Hawks this season?
Well, they have different options. I mean, the starting lineup, I think, is going to be pretty straightforward. It's going to be Trey at the one, Bogdan Bogdanovic at the two, DeAndre Hunter at the three, John Collins at the four, Clint Capella at the five. I think that's pretty much set. As far as closing the lineup, they do have some different options. I mean, Capella, sometimes you want to take him off and you can put in Gallinari and then play Collins at the five. They will close with Capella sometimes. So really, I would say that it's most likely going to be either Capella or Collins at the five for closing. But they have a lot of options. You know, sometimes Herder can work in there. There's just a lot of different guys that can get hot. Lou Williams can get hot and they can close with him sometimes. But yeah, they have a lot of options.
Yeah, they really do. In the versatility of the guys that are, you know, two through four, and really Collins and Okongwu being able to play, even, you know, Collins being able to play the four, the five, Okongwu being able to give you a bunch of stuff at the center position, just really incredible versatility on the wings on this roster. All right, you may not have something, so I hate to put you on the spot like this, but do you have a bold prediction for Atlanta this season? And one that you're comfortable sharing on the podcast here.
Yeah, I think so. You know, we talked about DeAndre Hunter earlier in the podcast. I mean, he was really a top 75 player in the league, honestly, for the first 20 or so games that he was healthy. A very critical two-way piece. I think he's going to build on that this coming season. He appears to be getting fully healthy from his knee injury. And I think he can make the leap to an all-star player in his second year. I mean, I think the Hawks are going to be pretty good, you know, a 3 or 4 seed. I think he's the kind of guy that will garner respect from coaches. And I'll say as my bold prediction that he makes the all-stars this year.
I love it. And I'd certainly like it. Yeah, the prospects of Atlanta perhaps as the top 4 team in the Eastern Conference. It's going to be competitive in that range, but this team could be, they're going to be interesting no matter what. And they also could be really, really good. Well, look, Andrew, I cannot thank you again for your time coming on here. We really appreciate you being a part of the Southeast Southeast Division preview with the Atlanta Hawks. Anything you'd like to promote here, or if you want to tell people where they can follow you on Twitter? I know we touched on that at the top, but if you want to plug it again here at the end, the floor is yours.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me on. It's cool to be in a Hornets pod. I think that they're one of the most fun teams to watch in the league. You know, we've seen some really special, I think, seasons from rookie guards recently. We've had Ja Morant and Trey. And I think that, you know, I know LaMelo had the injury, but from start to finish, I mean, I think he might have had the best rookie season that we've seen among those young point guards in recent years. And I think that says a lot about the talent that he is. So he's a player that, you know, in a team that I'm really looking forward to watching next season. You can find me on Twitter, A. Kelly, A-N-D-L-A-N-K-E-L on Twitter. I write for Peachtree Hoops. But, you know, mostly I like to fire off the takes on Twitter, have a good time.
Not too much content,
but, you know.
Yeah,
I appreciate you having me on. I'm looking forward to watching the Hornets next year. I'm a big P.J. Washington fan. I really like the step that Miles Bridges made this past season. And I like the draft, too, so excited to watch them.
Yeah, the I-85 rivalry, Atlanta and Charlotte. There's some really, really intriguing players, young athletes on both those two rosters. But yeah, make sure you follow Andrew. Just great Hawks content on Twitter, and sort of a must follow, I think, really for paying attention to what is going to be, could be, you know, one of the top 7, 8, 10 teams in the league next season. That's getting better and has a ton of good young players and a guy like Trey that they're going to build around and just be probably a competitive and very good product for a long, long time here. But anyways, we appreciate everyone tuning in to this episode of Buzz Beat. Keep it tuned in, I guess, for more Southeast Division previews on the horizon. See you guys next time.